Mr. Chairman and board members, my name is Alfred Wanger. I'm the Deputy Director for the Water Quality Program at the California Coastal Commission. We've been working in partnership with your board, board staff, the other boards around the state, and the state board as joint lead agencies for the California's Nonpoint Source Pollution Control Program, which was federally approved by both NOAA and EPA in 2001. We've also been working with the boards on a number of issues of protecting coastal water quality up and down the state, figuring out how to implement phase one and phase two stormwater permits in local land use planning and development processes up and down the coast. And I wanted to come to speak in support of the staff recommendation and the staff development of the stormwater permit in the current draft. Particular emphasis on the provisions supporting low-impact development tools and techniques and its implementation early in the design and development process. Our work with a number of entities, including an organization called the California Water and Land Use Partnership. It's made up of a number of NGOs, universities, regulatory agencies, local government representatives, and others have been looking at this issue of land use and water quality across the state for about the last half dozen years. We've seen that the changes in our watersheds related to changes in land use, the development, the creation of impervious surfaces, which is reflected a bit in the permit here, play a key role in their impacts in the water resources in the watersheds and in the coastal waters and ocean resources as well. This current permit, I think, makes a rather progressive statement as compared to the other stormwater permits that have been developed. Phase one permits have been developed around the state over the last 6 to 8 years. Laying out a strong emphasis on the use of LID in new and redevelopment projects is, I think, a critical piece of the stormwater permit, and I hope that you continue to maintain support for that. One other thing I just want to mention, I keep my remarks very brief here, is the permits, I can't remember the specific provision, but asking the permittees to do some training and outreach to the stakeholders who are involved in the development process about how to use these techniques. We worked last year with a number of boards and other entities to support, to do a number of LID-related trainings up and down the state. We held four workshops. We had over 750 attendees at those four workshops, the one here in, nearby in Oakland. In particular, 280 folks show up to that from all ranges, from local county municipalities, engineers, home builders, private property owners, developers, and others who are anxious to learn how to use these tools and techniques, where to use them, how do they fit into the design of their projects, how do they fit into a watershed context. And I think that this permit begins to lay some groundwork for those tools to be and techniques to be implemented not only on projects, but to begin to be implemented on a watershed scale. As we begin to see the increase in impervious surface throughout our watersheds, we see the degradation of these of our watershed resources, water resources and natural resources. Once you begin to reach certain thresholds, about between 10 and 25%, you begin to see active degradation. Over 25%, you really see destruction of our water resources. In certain areas, particularly in vulnerable coastal watersheds, even small amounts of poorly constructed impervious surface and new developments, commercial developments in other areas, can have a rather devastating impact on local sensitive resources. So I just want to, again, give some props to your staff for coming up with, I think, a progressive framework on that. And in the training and education component here, I'll just mention that Roger Briggs, who's the executive officer in Region 3, and I briefed perhaps a number of you and the other board members from all the regional boards and state board last fall on an education, training, and outreach program that we had developed in partnership with a number of folks around the state that is designed to try to provide this type of information that you're calling for in this permit, to get the information to the engineers that's necessary, to the planners, to the developers, builders, bankers, and others, all folks involved throughout the development process, to understand how to use this, where to use this, how it's appropriate, and how to make sure it's successful not only from the design phase, how it's to be constructed, and to be maintained through time. And so there are a number of resources that are available to the county, to the city, and to your staff that could provide that kind of assistance and training and education to make this a successful program. And I'd like to mention that there are a number of one of the earlier speakers was, I can't remember exactly who it was talking about the outreach to schools on these issues as well. There are a number of resources that are out there as well. So not to say that these things are being done in a vacuum, but there are a number of statewide resources that can be brought to bear to support this effort as part of the implementation. I'd like to offer my support to continue to work with your staff to make sure that that happens and to work with the county municipalities here to get them the assistance that they need to make this helpful. And I'll just limit my remarks to that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Any questions? I have one. I believe the program you're discussing is in the yellow pages, page 24 of 62, page 25 of 62, business program, corporate outreach.
Actually, I was looking on in the permit itself on page 38, subsection 4. Says that the co-permittees shall facilitate implementation of LID by providing key industry, regulatory, and other stakeholders with information regarding LID objectives, specifications, et cetera. And then it lists out a number of the professionals, the types of information that they might need. And so this nearly directly reflects the statewide training framework that was developed to support this. You know, with the current bond freeze and funds freeze that everybody's struggling under, that program has slowed down a bit. But the California Association of Stormwater Quality Agencies, or CASQA, has been a key member of developing that. I think the city of Santa Rosa is a member of CASQA, and they're working to bring these resources available, at least online initially, and to provide direct training to municipalities where they so need so.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Eugene Brownlee, EPA, followed by Randy Collins.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Eugene Brownlee of the NPDES Permits Office in EPA Region 9. We submitted comments on the draft MS4 permit for Santa Rosa on July the 6th, and there's one issue that we'd like to follow up on regarding the permit. And that's the issue of the requirements in the permit related to the Laguna de Santa Rosa TMDL. As you know, NPDES permits need to be consistent with the assumptions and requirements of applicable waste load allocations. But when you look at this Laguna de Santa Rosa TMDL, it just seems too vague to us to include the waste load allocations in the permit at this time. The TMDL refers to an anticipated compliance date of July 2000, but doesn't clarify whether that's intended to be enforceable or not. We think the solution is to update the TMDL and clarify the requirements. We understand that's underway. Clarify whether what the waste load allocation is for the MS4 and what the enforceable deadline is for the waste load allocation. So for the moment, anyway, we'd suggest that you just leave the waste load allocation out of this permit. When the TMDL is updated, you can include that in the next permit, or even better, reopen this permit and include the waste load allocation during the term of this permit if the thing is completed in a timely manner, like LA County or Board 4 did for the Santa Monica bacteria TMDL. I also want to say that it's important, very important to us, that when you have an applicable waste load allocation with a clear compliance deadline, that appropriate requirements go in the permit. And we've been stressing that in our comments on other MS4 permits in California. And we're also encouraging the boards to include numeric waste load allocations directly in the permit, as opposed to some set of BMPs that you might think or may not actually do the job. Some examples of that would be Orange County and Ventura County, where this was done. One other thing. We would encourage the board to include the BMP requirements that were talked about on the Mona's presentation. BMP requirements for nutrients. We think you can justify them on other bases besides the TMDL, like the MEP requirements and the state's iterative process leading to compliance with water quality standards. So we think that the BMP requirements related to nutrients can be justified on other grounds. So we would certainly encourage the board to retain the BMP requirements for nutrients that are in the permit. We note there are a lot of issues have come up today from the other speakers, and I think that we can work with board staff in dealing with these. I think a lot of these things are going to need a lot of the comments are going to need more review, and we can work with board staff in coming up with appropriate responses to those. I know one of them that came up was this permit boundary, and how did Sonoma County get to be a Phase One permittee in the first place? And the Phase One regulations require permits for incorporated places with a population over 100,000 and nearby interrelated MS4s, and that's how Sonoma County was drawn into this. So I mean, Sonoma County as a Phase One permittee is the decision the board made a long time ago, and I think this question has come up a couple times, and I know the state board has certainly frowned on going from phase one to phase two, but that may be an issue that we would need to look at again and see whether that sort of thing is possible or what. But anyway, I just wanted to clarify or add to what we had said about the TMDL in our letter commenting on the draft permit, and we think that the thing is just too vague at the moment to include the numeric waste load allocations in this permit, and the thing to do is just update the TMDL and clarify it and include that in the next permit or reopen this permit. So that was the main thing I wanted to comment on today.
So if I may, as I hear that, then you're saying you're okay not bringing the Laguna TMDL into the MS4.
Right, not including the waste load allocations in this permit.
And did I read the same thing about that earlier, or is that a different take than what EPA was coming at this from before?
Well, we had said in our letter that you should, but I think that we had assumed that somewhere in the TMDL it would have clarified what the compliance date was, and the fact sheet ought to clarify that, and then when we went back and looked at the TMDL, we couldn't find it. So it's too vague, and so.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you for coming. Thank you for comments. Randy Collins, followed by Eric Hawk from the Mosquito and Vector Control District.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, fellow board members. My name is Randy Collins. I'm the fire chief with the city of Healdsburg, but I'm here on behalf of the Sonoma County Fire Chiefs Association, an organization that represents 45 fire agencies in Sonoma County that range from fully paid departments with over 100 staff to all volunteer departments with less than 10 persons. When we first reviewed the draft document last fall, we were concerned to find a provision that identified the collection of waters from emergency firefighting operations in the document. As you might suspect, this would have put us in an extremely difficult situation of deciding whether to engage in emergency operations or pursuing BMPs upon our arrival at fire scenes. Well, in response to our request, last October, Engineers Short and Daugherty were kind enough to meet with us and our representatives of our organization. Excuse me, I do have a cold. And would like to acknowledge their cooperation and the changes they made, which I believe resolved the provision in the second draft. However, still included in the draft are provisions which include activities that need to be taken by fire departments for flows generated during training and repair activities. Given the diversity of the fire agencies in the county, this could be very problematic. While larger fire agencies like my own may have the staff and expertise to deal with such flows, Most have very limited resources, and when conducting training or repair activities, may inadvertently violate the MS-4 permit requirements and be subject to fines that could easily exceed the entire budget of some volunteer departments. When I raised these concerns in a subsequent meeting held with staff, they did indicate their openness to allow us to work with them to develop and implement our own BMPs for your approval. I have come here today to ask that you give not only staff, but our organization the support, the flexibility, and openness to develop and adopt such BMPs, including those that provide a reasonable means of protection to receiving waters, yet give all fire agencies the flexibility to conduct fire training operations and to repair and maintain fire protection systems as required under other provisions of state law. If this isn't taken into consideration, it will result in a system that is designed to fail and could have disastrous consequences for those very fire agencies that provide protection to everyone in this room as well as the communities they serve. Again, I would like to extend my appreciation to your staff, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Randy. Questions? I have one in terms of training. What's the... Maybe it's all different, but are they short-term, are they long-term? How much training do firefighters get?
It really depends upon the organization. Some larger organizations have daily training for every shift. Other organizations, smaller volunteer fire companies, it may be only two or three times a year where they perhaps get a structure that they can burn down and actually do practical, hands-on firefighter training. And in some cases, those activities may be prohibited depending upon how restrictive the BMPs are. And that's the kind of flexibility we're looking for.
So again, what I heard you say is that you're satisfied that something was taken out in terms of fire flows, but what's left in is the repair and training two issues?
Correct. Correct. And staff has indicated a willingness to work with us in developing BMPs that work for us. But I've come here because I really want to emphasize and stress to this board that that flexibility is critical, because if we do not have it, it could very well prohibit us from doing the very things that make us proficient in our own jobs and cause direct conflict with state law, which requires us to maintain other fire protection components.
And in terms of BMPs, for what kinds of things would you envision they would cover? Are they in some manual somewhere and you would just adopt?
Well, some of the things we've talked about is an education program. I've spoke about the diversity of fire agencies, and some have virtually no understanding of some of the things that are being proposed here today, while others do. And, you know, we've expressed our interest that as our organization be the vehicle to develop informational materials so people have a better understanding to minimize any impact to receiving waters. So that would certainly be one. There's probably more aggressive measures that could be taken, but those usually end up having to buy things like sodium thiosulfate systems and things like that, special mats for drain inlets and a number of other things, which may be very challenging for some departments.
And is there some kind of an average number of fires per year? How many?
Well, I could only speak for my own agency. We have about 70 structure fires a year. Most are smaller fires that are contained to like a stovetop and things like that. They're not the full houses that burn down. Those are probably about half a dozen, but that's reflective of an agency that serves about 12,000 people. Those statistics tend to be pretty uniform, so if you just multiply those factors by the population of the county, you could probably get a pretty accurate census of the number of fires.
And do you treat different commercial or industrial fire different than a residential fire? How do you, specific to the water leaving the site?
Very much so. We We are actually trying to be pretty aggressive in terms of when we have fires or incidences in commercial occupancies in retaining any runoff from those, because we recognize in almost any commercial occupancy there's going to be hazardous materials. We have aggressive hazardous materials inspections programs, as since we're the authorized CUPA, to follow through in that. But then again, we're unique. We're only one of four fire agencies that's a CUPA in the county, so we're not characteristic. So that's why I say the diversity and the flexibility is critical, because what we do, because of our knowledge and expertise and training and background, may not necessarily be implemented by a number of other fire departments, particularly these volunteer fire companies who have maybe 20 members who are in there. They're all volunteer.
And all this, while I'm thinking of it, posed to staff, I won't ask you to answer, Randy, but in terms of the differences between a phase one and a phase two operation for fire as they currently stand. So when you come back, I'll bring it up again. So, anybody else? Mr. Horn.
Hey, Randy, can I ask on an unrelated issue? You're a CUPA, correct? Healdsburg's its own CUPA.
Correct.
Do you have a stormwater component to your CUPA inspection?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact.
And yeah, what does that look like? And would a permit of any form, MS-4 permit, increase your load as what you do now?
It would probably add probably about, I'm guessing, half a dozen to a dozen additional things that we would check for when we go into the business on our inspection checklist.
Do you see that as unreasonably burdensome?
The biggest problem we have now is with people who currently violate the existing permit that's in place or the existing conditions and requirements we have. So I would foresee us doing enforcement activities regardless. I suspect it would increase, but it would be difficult for me to project what those would be.
Because the CUPAs are rather broad, right? You do everything from your hazardous materials in. You just picked up the spill plan component and the above-ground tank component, correct? So, I mean, that's a kind of ever-growing wide breadth of things that you're doing.
It is. In fact, I just sat through 24 hours of instruction in that very topic, so I can fully empathize. So I would, but then again, we're not typical. I mean, I like to pride ourselves on having a very aggressive program. We've worked with staff here for a long time on underground tank cleanup issues in the Healdsburg area. But we're only one of four, and there's that other 42 fire agencies, and they're not all doing the same thing we are.
And your CUPA for the tank program extends to Sebastopol as well?
It does. We have a JPA to do all elements of the CUPA program in Sebastopol.
So your footprint isn't only Healdsburg on CUPA. So do you do all the CUPA inspections in downtown Sebastopol, essentially?
We do, within the city limits.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Eric Hawk, followed by H.R. Downs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name's Eric Hawk. I'm with the Marin Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control District. What I'd like to do is to briefly provide some background and some comment on the draft permit relative to mosquito production, mosquito control, and public health. Over the past several years, the district has had substantial issues with specific types of stormwater BMPs and some of the general practices, mainly including management and maintenance of these systems, particularly bioswales and stormwater retention detention basins. And some of the issues that exist have been these haven't been draining properly due to improper design and function, so standing water into the spring and summer months, and in some cases throughout the summer months. And this standing water in and of itself provides mosquito habitat, but also provides habitat or brings in aquatic vegetation that often becomes very dense and abundant and increases the habitat value for mosquitoes. And unfortunately, the types of mosquitoes that prefer this type of habitat are in the genus Culex, which are primary vectors for West Nile virus and some of the other encephalitis viruses as well. Also, lack of management and maintenance with regard to vegetation, sediment removal in some of these systems. I would also like, I'd like to acknowledge staff, Mona Doherty and John Short, for working with us to resolve some of these issues. I would like to also say that the district strongly supports some of the new elements within the draft permit that we believe will remedy some of these issues. Some of these issues, or some of these elements in the permit include moving towards a priority of the low impact development types of stormwater treatment, a development of tracking, inspection, and enforcement systems for post-construction BMPs. And several of these issues we found with some of these BMPs have both been during construction and post-construction as well. A verification of maintenance provisions, that will be key. A regular inspection of the construction BMPs to assess the operations, including the vector risk, is very important to us. The provide data and observations on local effectiveness and performance of the BMPs. A visual flow monitoring also. Summer flows have been a huge issue in many BMPs for us. Required investigation and tracking of all discharge complaints. And a BMP plan for all authorized non-stormwater discharges as well. We believe these new elements within the draft permit, if adopted, would minimize the potential for mosquito production, the need for repeated applications of mosquito larvicides to these systems, and, again, the potential for vector-borne disease transmission.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? One, in terms of the frequency, you mentioned bioswales and the poor design, standing water. I mean, is that 1 out of 10, or is that 5 out of 10? And we have 10 today and 100 tomorrow. I mean, what?
Off the cuff, that's difficult for me to put a number to. We've had several issues in both Marin and Sonoma County. Just that come to my mind, we've had half a dozen bioswales and retention basins that have been significant issues. And when I say significant, I personally work on these. Some of these I've dealt with for 3, 4, 5 years plus, trying to get compliance and get management maintenance in these, get them to function properly so that water drains out of there. And these have began during construction of a development and continued throughout the post-construction. They are transferred, the responsibilities transferred to homeowners associations or the city. And you know, the district has had to track this and try to get compliance under the health and safety code. And it's been very time-consuming and difficult for us to do that, get the compliance and the enforcement. And then all throughout this whole time period, our staff and technicians are having to do the mosquito surveillance and the control operations, again, applying mosquito larvicide to these in an attempt to get control. And the very difficult and concerning part is that many of these stormwater systems are within communities and with, you know, high population densities of people, with these mosquitoes coming off as adults in the thousands, potentially, in some of these systems. Very concerning with respect to potential for West Nile virus transmission. And with these aquatic vegetation and these maintenance issues, it makes it much more difficult for us to apply these larvicides. And in some cases, we only have, it comes down to one granular larvicide that we can use to penetrate vegetation, algae mats, debris in these systems and attempt to get control. And if that fails, we're really out of options.
And time of year, I mean, is this some, what you're describing, needing to go in and treat, is that something you do late spring, and beginning of the summer, or is it late in the summer?
It varies by year, of course, with rainfall, but it can begin as early as mid-February and then go through October. Some years it's not till March or April, and it can end up September. It just depends on our weather and rainfall patterns. But typically these systems after, you know, 72 hours, 4 or 5 days at the maximum after a stormwater event, as you all know, they should be drained and empty. But what we're finding, that's not the case. And every single one we've had in Marin and Sonoma County, and that's been in the dozens, we've never seen one drain properly. And they hold water in 4 or 5 days. In the heat of the summer, we can have mosquitoes come on from egg to adult and be flying and biting in that amount of time.
You're saying that they'll hold water in the heat of the summer?
As you get into the middle of summer and the temperatures increase, the mosquito cycle can increase.
Shorten.
So, you know, in 5 days, and that's as fast as it gets, from egg to a flying adult. The temperatures are cooler. It can go for 7, 10, 14 days. It really depends, but that's something that we have to assess all the time and strategize how to apply these larvicides and get control of these populations. So very time-consuming and
for and these staff. Sites, are they the size of this room or the size of the table?
They vary. From the size, it can be everything, from the size of the table to the size of this room to twice the size of this room. We run into all of them, and it can be retention basins in series with bile swales connecting them or leaving them and going into the stormwater system. So it's really a range.
These are early attempts at low impact development. The types of bioswales you're seeing, are they the ones that we envision more of in the future?
To be honest with you, I hope not. No, low impact development that would be beneficial would be the landscape based treatment, the soil based, subterranean flow type of systems would be very beneficial and essentially eradicate potential mosquito production. So to have any kind of overland flow situation through vegetation is not desirable. And if it needs to be, that vegetation management is really going to be key, and these systems can't be let go and get tall, robust densities of a vegetation where the water will hold back and not drain as it should.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
H.R. Downs, followed by Alan Levine.
Mr. Chairman and board members, thank you very much for this opportunity to make some comments here. In general, my name is H.R. Downs with the Owl Foundation, and we pretty much support what you've done already on the draft permit. It looks very good in many ways. I have a very narrow focus here of something that I just wanted to go over with you to make sure that you understood what is going on with the non-stormwater runoff material and what is in that and part of the recycled water picture. I sent a letter that was footnoted with a lot of the points about what we're really concerned about. Some of the most important things that are not removed from sewage treatment or that not completely removed from sewage treatment include such things as antibiotic-resistant genes and pathogens. The antibiotic resistance, it's really difficult to exaggerate how bad this situation is. We have, just by coincidence, the appearance of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus appeared about the time that we started allowing solid wastes to go out in open dumping. This could be just a coincidence, who knows, but this is something that definitely needs a lot of study. Antibiotic resistance, there's many things that contribute to it, but unquestionably, recycled water is playing a significant role here somehow, and this has really got to be looked at. Despite whether or not you have just the pathogens that are making it through, and this all becomes part of the runoff. Even pathogens that have been broken open and the cell walls have opened up and disgorged their genetic material, that material is available then for other pathogens who are actively shopping for genetic defenses against antibiotics. And as you know, a sewer plant is a container that is accepting all of the pathogens and all of the antibiotics from an entire sanitary district. It all goes into a single focused container, and many of these pathogens would never have an opportunity to come in contact with each other in the wild, but they do in sewer plants. And this stuff is happening all over the world. And what I sent you in my letter, every point that I made, I tried to back up with a peer-reviewed scientific study that shows, demonstrates how this stuff is happening everywhere. And this is not new. This has been known for years. A lot of the problems with trying to detect what is going on in sewage plants, these have been studies that came out by WRF. Some of these studies are in the library in Santa Rosa. So everyone has been warned about this, but it's becoming a lot worse. Some of this material that will go off is able to be taken up by plants. So when we are using this stuff for as a substitute for fresh water, some plants will actually take up the contaminants, and this has been demonstrated with both bacterias, also viruses, heavy metals. There was a very famous case in Georgia where hundreds of cattle, dairy cattle, died because of biosolids that had been distributed on the farm. But the interesting thing is they didn't die from eating the heavy metals that were on the ground. They died from eating hay that had been fertilized with this stuff. So it definitely goes into plants, and you have to be very careful about that. In fact, there was a in the there were two lawsuits, by the way, that EPA lost in terms regards to this contamination issue. And a local paper in Augusta, Georgia, had pointed out that even the milk had been contaminated with thallium. Now, another thing is some of the materials that we've been heard with, that we know have been get through treatment plants, for example, endocrine disruptors, phthalates. Phthalates is these are a family of chemicals that mimic estrogen, and which can be extremely disruptive to wildlife and human life. These things are often described as being in trace amounts or minuscule. Well, phthalates are biologically active in parts per trillion. So, I mean, this is an amazingly potent kind of chemical. That's why hormones are so strong and they do what they can do. Another thing are chlorine that is in treatment plants. Some treatment plants rely on chlorine for disinfection. Some don't. Some use UV. But chlorine is in the system, and when it comes into the system and it connects with things like MRSA, this methicillin-resistant staph, which escaped the hospital setting and is now endemic in the community, this will chlorine will actually enhance exotoxins, hemolysins, leukocidins, coagulases. These are all of the materials of this bug that makes it virulent and infectious. And so it will actually enhance some of these things. Also, chlorine will react with acetaminophen. And acetaminophen is, it just happens to be the leading cause of liver failure in the U.S. It is one of the most ubiquitous drugs consumed. It is very common in sewer plants. When that comes into contact with chlorine, there was a study that I showed you on that, it will create two new toxicants, and neither one of those toxicants were ever introduced to the waste stream. These were created in the plant itself. And before this study had come out, no one had realized that this kind of activity was going on. And when, but it does show that it is impossible for anyone to declare that the material, recycled water, the effluent that is coming out of a sewer plant is actually contaminant-free, because there are things going on there that no one could possibly have predicted. And studies are coming out slowly showing what some of those things are specifically. Anyway, as far as we're concerned, we still have to upgrade a great deal of this stuff so it never gets into the runoff period phase, so that it goes into receiving waters. And to do that is going to require more advanced treatment, membrane treatment, and things like that. And even those have to be monitored because they're not foolproof. But I just wanted to kind of underscore what some of this runoff really has got in it and how important it is to clean it up. So thanks a lot for your help, and have a good day.
Okay. Alan Levine, followed by Brenda Edelman.
Good afternoon. My name's Alan Levine, and I live in Point Arena, but part-time in Santa Rosa, part-time. I'm director of Coast Action Group. Coast Action Group submitted comments to the initial iteration of the MS4 permit and the subsequent iteration of it. In both cases, Coast Action Group was generally supportive of the permit and conditions. Coastal Action Group asked for a better or greater explanation of BMPs and what they might look like, and this also links with the incidental discharge basin plan amendment, where there will be BMPs developed also. And I was told by your staff that the public would have input into what the BMPs are or become, and it would be a public process. So that might satisfy some CEQA requirements. I agree with the EPA about the old waste load requirements of the original TMDL. They're not accurate and shouldn't be referenced. And eventually, with the new TMDL, you'll have new WLAs and or load allocations, and that issue will be dealt with when that TMDL is finished. I believe that the MS4 permits for the city and the county is consistent with the regulatory mandates of the basin plant and the basin plant anti-degradation language. And this, your responsibility under state non-point source programs and other programs under the Coastal Zone Management Act. The real issue is with impaired waters, the Russian River and mainly the Laguna. I mean, both the city and the county have responsibility for what drains in there. And what is draining in there from MS4s is far greater than what is put in there in terms of nutrient and sediment from wastewater contributions to the Laguna. And you have a big problem in the Laguna, and you have a big problem in the Russian River, but I think that the Laguna issue goes way far beyond what's going on with the Russian River as far as public health issues are concerned. I would have liked to have heard more from the mosquito vector person about issues regarding La Luigia, which is basically a link to the sediment and nutrient conditions in the Laguna. What's confusing is both the city and the county say, we're not doing it. We're doing all we can to control pollutant inputs, and somebody else is putting them in. It's like finger pointing to the other entity. I know that the city has a creep stewardship program. I've reviewed that program, and I don't have all that much faith. It's somewhat helpful, but has great problems in the management of biologic or functional aspects of stream. There's some modifications that occur on a periodic basis that do not enhance. Actually, they're detrimental to the function of streams, and I'd like to see that be fixed. Coast Action Group has comments in the file regarding that management and stewardship program. County of Sonoma, I was just talking with Nathan. One of the things I was trying to get to happen with the city was that building inspectors, when they're on site, that they actually look at stormwater issues on projects. And the city just can't get it together to do that. It would solve a lot of expense and redundancy problems with inspections. And Nathan has informed me that the county does do it in some instances, but not all. So there's a lot that can be done in improvement, and I'm hearing a lot of negativity from responsible parties that have the duty to control pollutant inputs through MS4 under their jurisdiction. And I think that the board needs to move forward progressively to deal with issues to make the BMPs work and to make the policy work. I'm suspect of costs presented to the board. Either somebody's exaggerating or somebody's wasteful in their process. I don't know where the numbers are coming from, and I'm concerned about them. One question I would ask is, how many enforcement actions have occurred, either in the city and the county? I think the city provided that information. I don't know how successful the enforcement actions have been in the past. And last but not least is I'm not that happy with the application of the grading ordinance as far as the county's concerned. It's totally ministerial and may go completely away due to litigation. It's been litigated before. The newer iteration is somewhat better, but it doesn't really seem to be doing the job as far as controlling sediment and maybe even nutrient inputs to surface waters. So I'm done.
Thank you, Alan. Question for you. You made the statement that what's coming off the urban area pollutants is greater than from the treatment plants.
Maybe I didn't state that really clear. I think what's coming off of separate, I think the treatment plant contribution in nutrients is less than what comes off of both the city and county managed landforms. And I would put the primary responsibility on the county. Talking to Nathan, he says, well, some of those are direct discharges. That might be, but some of them are also discharges from MS4s. In fact, I'd say the greater number is coming from MS4s. Some of this will be dealt with in the TMDL, the direct discharge stuff from agricultural dairies on the Laguna.
Well, that's what I was just curious in terms of if you've what numbers you have that looked at to, and where those numbers are, how they add up for you.
They're working on that with the TMDL. I mean, I've gotten this secondhand from discussions with your scientists and other scientists that work on the Laguna. Stormwater inputs are bigger than wastewater inputs.
And when you say the inputs, you're...
Pollutant inputs.
Pollutant?
Yeah, nutrients and sediment. The sediment in the Laguna didn't all come from the city. You go upstream on the Laguna, and it's full of sediment all the way to Rona Park. Where'd all that stuff come from? Yeah. It came from construction projects. It came from hydro modification issues that weren't dealt with. You have increased or decreased lag to peak flow runoff. It's more hydraulic energy, more erosion. Every time you have an impervious surface, there's more water coming down faster. It moves sediment with that water. It's brown. And then you have a low gradient situation in the Laguna. It's flat, doesn't move. All that sediment drops out. And there's nutrients in the sediment. It's not, in fact, topsoil is very nutrient laden. It's not, you know, all dog excrement or cat excrement or fertilizer from lawns. It's a combination of everything.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brenda Edelman, followed by Don McInhill.
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I have to admit that this has not been a super easy process. I have all these notes here. I had hoped to be a lot more organized today, but the fact that much of what I have to say also needs to be said for tomorrow's hearing, I'm going to try not to do much repeating, but I may have to do some.
I think you'd have 8 board members that agree with that statement 100%.
I actually submitted comments both times to both versions this time around. And
said previously it may have been too ambitious. So,
well, I do want to say that I really strongly support about 80% of the permit. I realize that I don't have the same concerns about some of the details that other people in the room have, and I respect their need to fine-tune the document to suit their ability to comply with it. But really what, and I think your staff has done an excellent job, there's really only one segment of this that we're really concerned about. And we're going on the assumption that the that the proposed remedies will take care. I agree with Alan in the matter of the fact that that urban runoff is a very serious problem and is creating serious problems in the Laguna. Excuse me. I don't necessarily agree with the part that it's way worse than wastewater. I don't think we know which is worse. I think they're both of serious concern, and I just want to put wastewater on an equal footing here. In responding to the first set of comments, my comments had been broken up into 24 responses, and somehow more than half of my comments were not responded to, and I just want to put that in the record. I don't know why it happened. I was not contacted by staff about that. I just don't know if maybe the process was just as hard for them as it is for us. I'm sure it was, but at any rate, I wanted to mention that. What I'm really concerned about, my biggest concern is the incidental runoff issue, the non-stormwater runoff issue. And everything else in this permit basically deals with conditions that are existing now that have to be addressed because they are causing water quality impairment. With the case of the wastewater and the irrigation with wastewater, there is quite a bit of wastewater irrigation going on at this time. Most of it, I believe, comes under, at least insofar as the Laguna and the Santa Rosa area is concerned, most of it should be coming under Santa Rosa's reclamation permit. And I've been very concerned that the reclamation permit and the current irrigation by the city, at least in their ag parcels, the oversight has not been as good as it could be. And one of the reasons I'm really concerned about runoff from the irrigation is the whole issue of unregulated chemicals. The pharmaceuticals and personal care products that have unknown toxicity, and many of them are believed to cause serious harm to the environment, aquatic life, and human health. And they've been found in waterways and drinking water in the human body. And some believe they cause cancer and other serious diseases in adults, children, and pets, and may be the cause of diminishing and disappearing wildlife species. And this is a really significant issue, and the way it's been dealt with is that the state's water policy dealt with it by saying they set up this special expert committee that's going to look into the issue. And therefore, this document sort of claims that that's going to address the problem and that whatever is required down the road will be included at a later time. And basically, I have a real concern because there are a lot of existing conditions in the Laguna right now that, given we don't know everything that's wrong or what causes it, but any amount of irrigation runoff in the summertime is going to be a serious problem. We have new conditions in the river system that are currently existing and about to be made permanent that really isn't addressed by this document. And basically, those include things like the biological opinion, which is going to require a decrease in flows. The decrease in flows, I'm going to have some pictures tomorrow. I have one of the Ludwigi in the Laguna here, but I'm going to have a big one. Is contributing to all kinds of algae in the river, different kinds of algae. There's all kinds of Ludwigia growth in the river itself. If you go down to Stony Point, just south of the Roner Park Expressway, the whole creek area, and this picture portrays that, is totally filled in solid with Ludwigia, and they are a concern for the West Nile virus. not all of this is a result of wastewater, of course, but there's a huge amount of irrigation going on in the Rohnert Park Cotati area, which is very possibly contributing to runoff. And one of the concerns I have is that supposedly the BMPs would be determining the agronomic rates for each of the parcels that use wastewater. But it's unclear that that's happening now under the reclamation permit. And one of the things I discovered is that the depth of irrigation can go anywhere from 4 inches to over 35 inches on the properties that are irrigated with Santa Rosa's wastewater. And I don't know if anyone has determined or developed a report on how the agronomic rates for each of those parcels has been determined. And I know that it partly depends on crop and that the vineyards use a lot less than other crops. But nevertheless, there's many complicated factors that goes into making that determination. And every time I look at this picture, I think probably a significant amount of this could be from irrigation runoff from wastewater in the summertime. So the issues I'm really concerned about is the biological opinion is going to open up the decision 1610, which is going to permanently lower flows in the Russian River. And what's happening right now is there has been an emergency order to the state board that was granted to the water agency for this year that could bring flows down as low as 35 CFS in the lower river. Now, 35 CFS, the only time that was ever recorded was in 1977 during the big drought. So here we have not that big of a drought right now, but because less water is coming from the Eel River to Lake Mendocino. Lake Mendocino is at dangerous levels right now in terms of assuring that there can be fish migration in the fall. And so we're all faced with a severe water shortage. And this is where there's a nexus between water shortage and water quality. And anything that is done to contribute to, for instance, anything with the nutrients, anything added as a result of increased nutrients, could be a much bigger problem than it was in the past. In terms of the permit, my concern is that there wasn't enough of a description of the background circumstances in this regard. I don't recall seeing much about, if anything, about the lowered flows, and also we have a severe temperature problem. Temperatures have been averaging 22 to 25 Celsius in the lower river on cool days, and that was before the flows were lowered. And in my understanding is that's a range that can't be tolerated by salmonids, and we expect it to go even higher. So the temperature issue is another one that gets affected by all this. I was very concerned about whether or not these people who use Santa Rosa's irrigation water, and that includes Rohnert Park, Cotati, because Santa Rosa, of course, as you know, is in charge of a subregional system. And there, I want to just read just a couple of the water reclamation requirements. See, when the incidental runoff was added to this document and to the amendment tomorrow, it was with the understanding that it would offset some of the water use, and that was one of the main reasons that the state initiated a water recycling policy. And it's my contention that it would be much better to focus on conservation rather than, the city was complaining earlier about how much money this program would cost. What they didn't mention is that the program, if they get their basin plan amendment tomorrow allowing incidental runoff, they will be spending maybe as much as $150 million to be able to irrigate in the summertime up to 1 billion gallons of city wastewater. And that's a pretty expensive project. Whereas if that money was put into conservation, the water wouldn't be used at all. It wouldn't have to be cleaned up. It wouldn't have to be spread around with unknown consequences. And that's sort of a gross statement, but I think I could demonstrate in more detail were there more time that would be a far better way to go than to focus on a huge wastewater irrigation program. Now, the water reclamation, I saw an article in the PD a couple months ago. I included this with my comments. I brought copies for each of you because I thought it was really important that you see this. On the there's this Sara Lee and Richard Cundy. I don't want to say anything negative about them except that they're doing something they don't seem to understand the impact of what they're doing in terms of they have a 15 million gallon pond that's on the front picture here that your agency didn't know anything about, doesn't know if there's other wastewater ponds in the system, didn't have any oversight over it, doesn't know if it's legally or appropriately configured. And in the reclamation requirements, it says, all reservoirs and ponds shall be adequately protected from erosion, washout, or flooding from a rainfall event having a predicted frequency of once in 100 years. Well, there's no indication that anybody has seen that or looked at it or provided information that is indeed being adhered to. So it's really a great concern. And in the article, Sara Lee alludes to using this water for frost protection. Well, in this reclamation permit, it says, recycled water shall not be applied to irrigation areas during periods when uncontrolled runoff may occur. And that's what happens during frost protection. You use a large amount of water in a short amount of time and it runs off. Recycled water shall not be applied in any manner so as not to exceed vegetative demand or field capacity. That's the agronomic rates. Where's the information on that? I don't think there is any. And I know that staff has a lot on their plate and that they're shorthanded much of the time, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anybody, but I think this is a serious problem. And yet this document is trying to make the case that these BMPs will assure that except on very, very unusual occasions, there will not be any runoff. And they keep mentioning broken sprinkler heads. But then the city requested that they add things, and one of the things that got added is overspray. And I'd like to know how you would measure overspray and determine that that's an incidental runoff. I know I've been talking a long time. I have no idea how many minutes I've been going here, and you have other speakers. So I think I will try and organize my thoughts better tomorrow and maybe come in with an outline or something, but I appreciate your consideration, and I would like to leave these for the board members.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you. Don McInhill, followed by Phoebe Groh. And Phoebe's the last card I have, which somebody might, somebody might try, and then that guy tries.
Good afternoon. My name is Don McInhill. I work for Russian Riverkeeper, and I've certainly been focused on stormwater issues and monitoring for years. Recently, I think in April, there was a special on PBS, the show Frontline, called Poisoned Waters. It was about our used to be pristine, productive estuaries, the Chesapeake and the Puget Sound. And they detailed the problems with both those estuaries. They're vastly different than the Russian River watershed, a lot of similarities with the Laguna. But in detailing all the issues, they interviewed a lot of different regulatory people. They talked to a lot of people from the Mid-Atlantic, I guess, region of EPA. And one of the interviewers asked one of the regulators, who obviously had been working on trying to restore the Chesapeake for decades, people care about the Chesapeake River, people's livelihood, or the bay, and their livelihoods depend on it, and it affects people's health. Why haven't we addressed this issue? This is not a surprise, the condition of the Chesapeake. We've watched it decline. And the official's quote was, people just don't care enough to pay. They want clean water. They like a healthy river. They like to be able to go out and fish and catch fish they can safely eat. But in the daily competition for costs, they just don't make it a priority. And so today there has been a lot of discussion of costs, and I just wanted to bring that up, that clean water is not free. There will always be a cost. I know in Hillsburg we assessed ourselves a huge amount of money to build the best water treatment plant for our sewage in this watershed, and certainly there was no revolts or anything like that. People understood we were doing this for the health of the river. One of the previous speakers, and I think one of the board members, talked about maximum extent practical, MEP, that it's a very squishy term, and it is, but probably the only thing more squishy than that is calculating costs associated with an MS4 permit program. I'm, you know, certainly aware of what other cities spend, and it was interesting to hear your staff, Mona, talk about the costs that have been calculated by the state and the EPA for different jurisdictions. And I just have to ask the question, how can Encinitas have a Cadillac program at $46 per household, but Santa Rosa and Sonoma County are talking about upwards of $150? Someone's got their numbers wrong. So obviously getting more information will be quite instructive and hopefully get to the bottom of that. But it is going to cost money. When we look at the trends in this watershed, just in the time I've been doing this job, we've seen multiple new impairments for the Laguna, which is the main drainage area for the subject permit. We've seen our fish populations in those watersheds decline. We've seen general decline of water quality, just degradation trends. And so it's hard to imagine that we're going to be able to escape paying something to fix those up. And I realize we're in a very, very tight economic climate, but certainly in our written comments, both on the first draft permit and the second permit, have suggested that efficiency should be the order of the day here. We can't do everything, so let's make sure we're doing the things that get us the most bang for our buck. Moving on, we do a lot of water quality monitoring. I gave a presentation at last month's meeting about Russian River first flush, and we do a lot of monitoring because monitoring is where we see how we're doing. It's basically taking the pulse of, in this case, our patient is the watershed, and determining via those vital signs how it's doing. In the context of this permit, best management practices without good quality iterative monitoring is like going to school but never facing a test. It's kind of like going to school over and over and over for 12 years and getting a high school diploma but never getting tested. Monitoring is integral to determining the efficiency and the effectiveness of BMPs. And certainly, hopefully, through good monitoring, we can figure out, and I know the permittees actually have a very, I think, good BMP effectiveness monitoring suggestion in their comments, and certainly have discussed it. And that monitoring is going to tell us what they shouldn't be spending money on and where they should put their money. One thing that I believe that the current monitoring program has a new requirement to monitor outfalls. I believe that this permit should absolutely monitor outfalls. Monitoring main stem streams like Santa Rosa Creek will allow dilution to hide that pollution. It's just a simple fact. When you get water coming from upstream of the municipal area, water coming from sources that aren't quite as pollutant, mixing with some of the individual outfalls that we've sampled in the past, we're not finding everything that's going along. You could have extremely high nutrient level at a certain outfall affecting a branch of a creek, and by the time it joins with the main stem can be diluted down to where it's not a problem. Just to illustrate, one thing the city of Santa Rosa has never tested for is pesticides, pyrethroids, and a recent Sacramento Bee article and a presentation to the Central Valley Regional Board found that the Sacramento urban area is the Delta's top pesticide source. And what they did was they monitored all throughout the general Central Valley area and found that we are getting a huge contribution of toxic levels of pyrethroid pesticides from our urban areas. They also sampled Vacaville, Stockton, and they also sampled treatment plants, and they sampled agricultural areas. So they were able to clearly isolate that these urban areas contribute pesticides. And don't forget, Sacramento is a phase one city. They do education to residences, to professional pest control applicators, and they still have a huge pesticide problem. In 2004-2005, under a state water board grant, we conducted the urban pesticide monitoring project in this watershed. And interestingly enough, we primarily sampled the water column. What we now know about pyrethroids is they bind with sediment and they almost immediately fall out and take up resident in the sediments. Out of the 160-some-odd samples we took for this project, we took 5 sediment samples. One of those sediment samples from a creek in Hillsburg killed 75% of the test subjects, which were the same subjects used in the Sacramento study. And we also did a chemical assay of that sediment and found bifenthrin, one of the pyrethroid pesticides. In Don Weston's work, who's the researcher who did all the work in Sacramento, he found that immediate areas right below the outfalls are incredibly toxic. You get further down from that and the toxicity starts to taper off. This outfall monitoring is really, really important to determine whether we're having problems that we're not seeing because we're sampling in the main stem instead of these smaller water bodies where the concentrations are higher. I think beyond that, let's see. I think specifically I have a huge issue with one of the monitored constituents, total phosphorus. In freshwater systems, phosphate is almost always your limiting nutrient. It's the one you need both nitrogen and phosphorus to make things grow, like Ludwigia, algae, trees, plants, crops. And when you run out of one of them, then that growth inducing ability is halted or limited. And usually in a freshwater system, and we certainly know it about the Laguna, that phosphate is the first thing used up. In the 2006 303D listing process, the EPA stated that they were going to list the Laguna over the objections of the state board because, and they used as their screening level, 0.1 milligrams per liter of phosphate. And yet the city of Santa Rosa and the Sonoma County stormwater permit are being allowed to monitor at 1.0 milligrams per liter, 10 times the level which causes or contributes. Actually, the level that causes impairment is probably far lower than 0.1. So I think that monitoring this phosphorus is a waste of money because in the summertime, we are never going to see 1 milligram of total phosphorus. But we could have a lot of organophosphate and you know, levels of total phosphorus that are lower that are causing and contributing to our continuing impairment. One quick comment while we're on the topic of monitoring and pollutants. One of the previous speakers spoke about exempting certain county areas from the phase one and making it a phase two. Well, you know, I think when you look at urban-like densities, there are islands in the county, such as downtown Guerneville, would certainly qualify. Downtown Guerneville has a stormwater system under its streets. It dumps it all into Fife Creek in an outfall under the River Road Bridge or Highway 116 Bridge. And we've monitored that for 6 out of the last 8 years and found that that individual outfall has consistently produced the highest numbers of dissolved metals, of nutrients, and in certain years we've seen the highest level of bacteria there and sediment. So even though some of these areas' populations in total, downtown Guerneville might be 1,200 people, we're seeing an astronomic contribution of pollutants. So I think keeping them in the phase one would certainly be my suggestion. I think going on from there, I'm just going to briefly read a quick quote and conclude from the National Research Council. They issued a report last year called Urban Stormwater Management in the United States. One of their main conclusions was EPA's current approach to regulating stormwater is unlikely to produce an accurate or complete picture of the extent of the problem, nor is it likely to adequately control stormwater's contribution to water body impairment. So our current permit system is obviously not, in the eyes of independent researchers, adequate, and yet we're being asked to roll it, to scale it back more because of cost. It's not going to get cheaper to clean up our waterways. And I really support this permit as written. I commend staff on all their work and meeting with the permittees 17 times. Boy, if they could make those meetings more efficient, they might save money. But I think this has been a very inclusive process, and I think the permit, the draft permit, this second revision, certainly meets the mandate of an iterative permit trying to get our hands on what is a runaway problem, which is stormwater, which is a problem not only here but throughout the country, and everyone's grappling with this. And so I support this permit, and I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Questions? I have one in terms of, you began by saying, quote, that we're not willing to pay. What are we willing to pay? What would you be willing to pay?
I think that we're being charged, I think, $12 a month in the city of Hillsburg. I know my house would be easily willing to go up to $50. And certainly looking at Encinitas, I don't know the details of that Cadillac program. But if $50 per household and per business was going into strictly stormwater reduction activities, not creek master plans and things like that, but things that directly are part of this permit, I think we could do a good job for that level. I know personally I'd be willing to go higher, but I have other people in my household who might disagree with me.
Well, I would... have you back up and go over those numbers again, because I'm not sure. I get a bill from the city of Healdsburg, opened it today. I don't see a $12 a month.
There's a stormwater utility fee, and maybe I'll talk to the utility folks and make sure they're hitting you as well, because I know I'm paying it. But it's something that unceremoniously showed up on our bill about 14 months ago.
Because then we're in a class of our own. If the other number is 46 a year, Healdsburg's 144 a year already. And
I need to look at my numbers.
The Mackinhill number is 600 a year, is what you said. So I'm not sure you want to live with that one.
Yeah, I think actually, is it? And I'm not sure if it's 46 a year or a month. But
it's a year.
It is a year. Well, that's damn cheap, in my opinion. $12 a month is not much to pay for a river we can safely swim in and fish we can safely eat. So,
all right. Thanks. Thank you. I don't have a card, but Dr. Smith.
Hi.
I don't have a card. Phoebe Groh. Sorry.
That's me.
I did call you out.
I'm Phoebe Groh with the Russian River Watershed Association. We're a collaborative organization of local public agencies here in the Russian River Watershed. Our member agencies include the three co-permittees, along with several Phase 1 communities, including Cloverdale, Cotati, Healdsburg, Ronert Park, Ukiah, and the town of Windsor. I want to say just first of all, RRWA is committed to achieving a healthier watershed by implementing effective regional programs. As such, we agree with the overall goals of the existing and draft permits. But in spite, we appreciate the efforts that the regional board staff have made in revising the draft permit. However, in spite of the revisions, we still feel that there's significant problems with the draft permit as it's currently written. The draft permit, as written, would place undue financial and administrative burdens on the co-permittees without providing commensurate water quality benefits to our region. Even in the best economic times, the very significant new costs associated with implementing the permit would be difficult for the co-permittees to absorb. With the current state of the economy, these financial burdens are even more onerous. I'll take a quick moment here to go over a couple examples which we've heard some about previously. As noted in comments from the City of Santa Rosa, the draft permit seems to indicate a requirement for mapping of all existing connections to the storm drain system. This would require the city to videotape over 300 miles of storm drain at an estimated cost of approximately $4.7 million. These staggering costs cannot be justified by the minimal indirect environmental benefits that might result from this exercise. That said, we understand there's some clarifications pending on that matter. But as discussed in comments from Sonoma County, the draft permit would require the county to take on an entirely new suite of inspections for industrial and commercial facilities. The county does not have the training, resources, or staff to implement this program, and we are concerned that these inspections do, in fact, constitute an unfunded mandate. In addition to these and other unnecessarily severe financial burdens, many timeframes in the draft permit are unrealistic and unreasonable. Furthermore, RRWA feels that the draft permit as written does not sufficiently acknowledge the ongoing efforts of the co-permittees and does not adequately consider conditions particular to our region. Some examples of this have been pointed out previously by the co-permittees. The draft permit, furthermore, lacks clarity regarding provisions, which provisions are applicable to each permittee. Finally, going over some territory that's already been covered, RRWA objects to the inappropriate inclusion of the 1995 waste reduction strategy for Laguna de Santa Rosa. This is not, it's our opinion and the opinion of several others that it's not a valid TMDL. And detailed comments regarding this matter have been discussed previously and submitted in writing from the city and the county. In conclusion, this is not the time for these costly and sometimes unworkable provisions. It's a time to take stock of the advances that have been made while prioritizing with communities where existing resources should be spent. As such, RRWA respectfully requests that the regional board consider further revisions to the draft Phase 1 permit that address the concerns I've outlined here and the concerns stated by the co-permittees. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon to Chairman Anderson and the members of the board. My name is Dave Smith, and I'm appearing here as a consultant to the City of Santa Rosa. I also serve as managing director for water reuse, which is the predominant international organization for water recycling research and development. I wanted to just respond to a couple of points that were brought up in previous comments to clarify the matter. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that this MS4 permit, the portion of it that deals with incidental runoff and the basin plan amendment that you're going to be considering tomorrow, bring the region into consistency with the state policy and state general permits in this regard, which have dealt with the issue of incidental runoff. And we agree with the staff's assessment that the BMPs, which have been submitted to you as part of the record that the city would be implementing, are going to reduce the amount of runoff, not only of recycled water, but of potable water as well, reaching the waters of the United States. There was mention that agronomic rates were not being adhered to in the existing reclamation system, and I'm here to tell you that that's not true. We're short of water. We have sold every drop of recycled water we produce, and we don't have one customer that's getting as much water as they want, and none of them are getting the amount that their crops would need. I also want to react to the assertion that recycled water runoff in particular creates some sort of toxicity or human health risk as a result of runoff. Recycled water treated to the tertiary level, properly applied, and by properly I mean consistent with the regulations that organizations like this places on projects like the city operates, has never resulted in a documented human health or aquatic toxicity event. There was a reaction to the fact that the state board has convened a panel to address unregulated compounds. I happen to serve on an advisory group to that panel, and that panel has been convened by the state to answer questions about water recycling and the presence of unregulated compounds, how they should be monitored, and it's premature until that board, according to the state board, until that panel concludes its work next year to implement regulations on those compounds. The outcome may be that monitoring is needed. The outcome may be that additional regulation is needed. But the state has begun a process to determine that, and we would encourage this board to defer to that organization, to the state board and its panel, to await the results and then regulate as appropriate based on the outcome of that process. We heard not only about, in the previous comments, about unregulated compounds, but we heard about regulated ones too, and that is nutrients in particular. And there was some debate among the commenters as to whether runoff or discharge of recycled water was the culprit of all the ills that plagued the Laguna. I want to point out that there are other sources as well, besides runoff, besides discharge, and I can tell you that there was no discharge in this last year, so we know what its contribution is. There are septic systems that are not functioning properly. There are agricultural operations that are not managed necessarily as well as they could be. There's aerial deposition. So I don't want us to lose track of the range of sources that your TMDL is going to address. There was concern voiced about drought conditions exacerbating water quality conditions, and that's true. I want to point out, though, that water recycling that the commenter referred to as a potential exacerbation of that problem is actually mitigating the problem. Without additional recycling, there is going to be more demand on diversions from the Russian River, and I think water recycling is being developed by the city and others to reduce reliance on the river, not to make water quality conditions worse. There was also an assertion made that board staff is not on top of the city's irrigation system as it relates to storage ponds on the Cundy property and the use of water for frost protection. I can tell you your staff is on top of that. They have asked the city for information about those uses of recycled water, and the city is in the process of preparing and providing that information to the city or to your staff. And lastly, I just wanted to comment about the request that overspray be added to the list of examples of causes of incidental runoff. We requested that irrigation overspray be added because that is consistent with the state water recycling policy. It is one of the examples given in the state water recycling policy of a cause of incidental runoff, and we felt it was appropriate for, wherever possible, this permit and the basin plan amendment to be consistent with state policy. So that concludes my remarks.
All right. Any questions? Okay. Any other last cards? All right. We'll have staff come back to the table. And I did pose the question in terms of the fire question, differences between phase one, which is the MS4 type permit, and the phase two